The All Souls Forum is a weekly broadcast here on KKFI every Thursday at noon. The All Souls Forum is a production of the Universalist Unitarian Church, 4501 Walnut. Each week they present a public forum whose mission is to deal with significant issues, especially those that involve ethical values of the contemporary world, and to promote critical thinking. So without further ado, here's this week's production of All Souls Forum.
Well, good morning. I'm George Baggett, a member of the All Souls Unitarian Universalist Church. I want to welcome you all to the All Souls Unitarian Universalist Church Forum. We are pleased to have Dave Helling, whose topic this morning is so perfect, the most important election of our lifetime again. With that, Dave Helling, famous Dave Helling, is going to take the floor. Thank you so much for coming, Dave.
Thank you, George, and good morning to everyone, and wave if you can hear me and see me, and that's all good, and it's great to see you all and my friends, and in this time of COVID, this is not the optimum way to talk, is it? But it's better than sitting in our homes and not chatting about these issues of importance, so it's always my pleasure to be with the Unitarian Church speakers program, particularly this close to an election. I think the last time I spoke with your group, I was just a straight reporter. As you may know, of course, since 2017, I've been writing editorials and columns for the Star. So it's okay for me to leak a little more personal opinion into these discussions than there might have been when I talked to you as someone who just reported the news. I'm going to make some observations about this year's elections from sort of a 30,000 foot level. And then if there are specific races or things you want to talk about, I'm sure we'll have plenty of time to discuss those issues as we go forward. But again, thanks for joining us and being with me and listening to me on this September Sunday. I've been called my speech the most important election again, as a joke, of course, because I think every 4 years we're told this is the most important election of our lifetimes. We were certainly told that 4 years ago when Donald Trump and Hillary Clinton were on the ballot. Going back to 2000, 1992, when it was Bill Clinton and George H.W. Bush, we've heard it over and over and over. And it is easy, it's called recency bias, it's easy to think, boy, we're really up against a choice here that will define our country every 4 years. But in this particular case, I think it's arguably true in a way that goes far beyond the specific choice we have at the top of the ticket, between Joe Biden and President Donald Trump. And instead, this election will reflect a broader, deeper, more fundamental concern about our republic, our small r republic, and the state of our democracy. Because I do think that the four-year presidency of Donald Trump has exposed some really serious cracks in the governmental system that the framers set up more than 200 years ago in the late 1700s. Because we're seeing the results of his approach to government impact itself on the way we reach political decisions that go far beyond the policy differences between Biden and Trump, or even between Republicans and Democrats, and really, in my mind, get at the heart of how we govern ourselves in this country. And so in that sense, this is an astonishingly important election because it will reflect, in my view, whether or not we will continue to pursue, if you will, the norms of our constitutional democracy, or whether they are fractured to such an extent that they'll need to undergo fundamental changes in the years ahead. So that's what I want to talk about a little bit today. And then again, I'll be happy to answer any questions on specific races or concerns that you might have. The framers didn't believe in parties. They called it faction, and they didn't really like the idea of political parties or groups getting together. They envisioned a legislative branch that was free and independent of the executive branch, and the decisions would be reached independently by wise men, and they were always men, of course, back then. So they would be astonished by what has taken place since, although, as I think we all know from our history, it took about 6 months for parties to start rearing their heads after the Constitution was ratified in the late 1700s. George Washington was a Federalist, and Thomas Jefferson was a Republican Democrat, or however you want to put it, anti-Federalist. But parties developed fairly quickly, and we have now, of course, broadly speaking, a two-party system between the Republicans and Democrats. Now, most people, interestingly, reject the label as a Republican or Democrat. The actual membership of parties has declined for many years. But broadly speaking, again, there is a polarized understanding of our politics that posit Republicans against Democrats. And most people fall into one or two categories, one of those categories, even if they don't call themselves by the party label. But that's important to understand, because we are in, you know, in the United States now, a polarized two-party nation in our approach to almost all political decisions, certainly at the national level, and to some degree, I'll argue, even in the local level. What is also clear from the statistics and from the discussions in our country is, by any measure, the Republican school of thought, the Republican approach, however you want to define that, is the minority view. That is to say, more people in votes, in polling, in discussions, support what we might call the Democratic approach to problem solving and to issues than the Republicans. And the statistics are very clear on this, and I'll just run through a few. Seven of the last eight presidential elections, the Democrat has received more popular votes. Democratic candidates for the United States Senate have received more popular votes in the last election than Republicans. In polling, in House races, although the House is controlled by the Democratic Party at this point, it's clear that Republican viewpoints are overrepresented in our legislatures and our national Congress. Now, that's not necessarily true in Missouri or Kansas, which have been and continue to be reliably Republican states at almost every level. Remember, Donald Trump won Missouri by 19 points in 2016, so that gives you some indication of the lean, if you will, of Missouri. Kansas had similar results. Having said that, you know, even in Missouri, we would argue that any general understanding of the state would suggest maybe a 53-47 split between Republicans and Democrats. And yet, Republicans control six of the eight House districts, all the statewide offices, and have veto-proof majorities in both houses of the legislature. I bring that up only to reflect the overlean, if you will, of Republicans in our representative bodies. Let me read you this real quick. I just popped this up. This is from a political science professor at the University of Denver, writing in the Washington Post 2 days ago. He says, "Our nation is moving even deeper into minority rule. The House aside, the U.S. government is controlled by the less popular party in a polarized two-party system." And it's just my view that is borne out by facts, and just every metric you might use, that turns out to be true. Another example, of course, of this lean is the Electoral College. I've written arguments against the Electoral College since I was 13 years old because of the manifest unfairness of a system in which the candidate with the fewer votes, at least the fewer popular votes, could be elected. Every argument there is against the Electoral for the Electoral College can be proven to be inaccurate. We can talk a little bit more about that if you want. I don't want to spend the whole morning rehashing that. But again, my broad point is that by any measure in this polarized society, again, in a national sense, more people support what we might think of as the Democratic view than the Republican view, and every statistic suggests that's true. Now, for the most part, voters in our country accept this. It doesn't really make people that angry or that frustrated with their government. That's also clear from the polling. For the most part, despite the decision of the Supreme Court, for example, in Bush v. Gore in 2000, or the president's election in 2016 by a minority of the popular, or less than the popular vote, even, by the way, with Bill Clinton, a Democrat who won with 43% of the vote in 1992, Americans accept the idea that on occasion, this country will be ruled, if you will, or governed by those who hold the minority view. That, I've often said, is a reflection of our understanding of the importance of minority rights. Now, not ethnic minorities, which is a whole other issue, but just the minority of voters. There is a great respect for the idea in our country that all sides should be heard at all times. And that when Democrats win, they don't shut Republicans out. And when Republicans win, they don't shut Democrats out. That there is a shared responsibility for governance, something that we all learn, don't we, in fourth grade civics. And so even with the inauguration of President Trump in 2017, there was an understanding and acceptance of the idea that in our constitutional democracy, sometimes these outcomes are unavoidable. The first editorial I ever wrote for the Kansas City Star was entitled, "Let's Give Donald Trump a Chance." And I think I still don't regret that editorial, because I do think it reflected an understanding among all people in our country, most people, that minority rights are to be protected, and that even if you get an aberrant outcome from time to time, that's acceptable in our constitutional system. But what Donald Trump has done over the past 4 years is to violate that understanding, in my view, because of his destruction, and there's no other way to put it, his destruction of political and presidential norms that we've come to expect from every president of either party since the beginning of the Republic, more or less. And there are examples of this all over the place. The president is untruthful all the time. He treats the government as his personal, he wants the government to serve his personal interests rather than the public interests. He tells untruths. He nominates people for high office, and has them govern without Senate approval. You just go down the list. The violation. He attacks his enemies personally. In almost every sense, he violates our understanding of what norms and behavior of a president should and could be. And because of that behavior, in my view, the acceptance of the American public of minority rule has started to seriously fray at the edges. And we're seeing some examples of this, of course, now, with the president's nomination to replace Ruth Bader Ginsburg on the Supreme Court, Amy Barrett, and the reaction to it is not based solely on her approach to the judicial system early in the morning, but rather the idea that the president, who represents a minority view, has been allowed to nominate 3 members to the court to be confirmed by a Senate that reflects a minority view. And so the frustration with that, which again might be acceptable in normal circumstances in this country, is now the focus of some fairly serious disagreement and pushback. Now, just quickly as an aside, I don't think it's going to make much difference. The Senate has the votes. They're going to do what they do. But the reaction of the American people, the majority of the American people, is reflective of an idea that if you are ruled by a minority, that minority must respect your rights as well. And that seems to have vanished from our politics. Again, that's just not limited to Congress. That's a part of local politics as well. You know, it isn't talked about a lot, but Mike Parson is the governor in Missouri. He was not elected to that job. And yet, certainly in his response to the COVID pandemic, there is enormous criticism of that. And the reaction has been, fairly clear by, again, lots of Missourians. And yet there is no, other than the election coming up, there's no legal way to get at that. So I guess the point I'm making is that when you violate the norms of elective office, that's always a problem, even if you're the majority party. But if you're the minority party, it really does get to be very difficult very quickly. Now, what does this bring, in my view? Well, I don't think it's going to be violent. I don't think people will violently resist the government, even if Donald Trump is reelected in 6 weeks. Although, if he's elected again with a minority of votes, the frustration of the majority will be, I think, quickly evident. If you'll remember, in 2016, they were marching in the streets within a couple of days. And I think that would come again. But actual violence, other than the very fringes of political thought in some cities, I don't think that's likely. I do think you're going to see a continuing concern about civil rights violations, which we can talk about in a few minutes as well. But what I do think will happen if there is continued minority rule in our country, and why this is the most important election ever, is if there is a sense that the system, the constitutional system in the United States, is fundamentally unfair, it will, in my view, serve to delegitimize the government itself. And people will begin to ignore what their government wants to do, or begin to feel as if they have no role in their government, particularly again at the national level, or that votes don't matter. And when that starts to happen, then when the government itself is not considered legitimate broadly, that makes governance very, very difficult. And you already see some examples of that in the dysfunction in our Congress. It's hard to think of anything the Congress has really accomplished over the last 2 years at all, other than the initial response to the COVID emergency, which was so dire that it demanded an answer. But beyond that, the other important problems facing the community, immigration, infrastructure, jokingly so, civil rights, voting rights, all of those important topics remain unaddressed by our government. And when that happens, in my view, some Americans, many Americans, may see themselves as the victims, not of a government, but in an occupying force, that the minority has occupied their lives in a way that delegitimizes the government itself. And that, I'd suggest, is a fundamental crisis, or would be a crisis, in our country. And that's why, my friends, this is the most important election ever. There is an inherent bias in our system that supports Republican minority rule. Rural interests are overrepresented, in part because our Senate and the Electoral College are dependent on geography, not so much people, but geography, artificial geography at that. And if there is a sense that after this election, those majoritarian views are not to be considered at all, and that norms will continue to be violated up and down the government, then I do think that the legitimacy of our constitutional republic will be in crisis. And whether that's an effort to, rewrite parts of the Constitution or rethink it, or whether millions of Americans drop out completely of participation in the system and begin to consider rules and regulations illegitimate, I don't know. But the norm destruction by this president, which I think is unquestionable, has created a situation in which the votes of this election will determine, in my view, whether there remains broad support for the government we all learned about back in fourth grade. You know, that may sound pretty dramatic, but I believe that. I just in talking with friends and neighbors and others in politics, there is a real sense that the Constitution itself is now on the clock, if you will. And the system, which was invented brilliantly in the 1700s, may not be precisely fit for the 2000s. And that this election and the last 4 years have shown that, and the reaction then will go forward. So with that in mind, that's my 30,000-foot look at what's happening in our country. I'm more than willing to talk about those observations and, of course, any specific race you might have on your agenda that we can discuss. So with that, Renee and George, I open it up however you want to open it up for questions and observations.
Let's go to Butch and Corva Murphy.
Dave, Corva and I wanted to know two questions. One is, what do you think about Obama's not endorsing Beaulieu? And secondly, what are the chances for Galloway?
Okay, two good questions and race specific. I'll start with Barb Beaulieu first. I had a long conversation many years ago with a name, a Republican consultant whose name you will recognize, who told me that polling showed that every time Barack Obama spoke in Missouri, that the popularity of Democrats for statewide races went down, and that he guessed was a residual concern about just sort of latent racism in our country. I don't think that exists in Kansas, or for that matter in Missouri, in the way that he was implying, but it's pretty clear that Barb Beaulieu does not want this election to be decided, A, on national grounds, that is to say, who's going to run the Senate and national, the national political dynamic. And two, that she is arguing strenuously that she is a bipartisan, independent figure, and that she is concerned that Barack Obama's endorsement would polarize the electorate in a way that she can't afford happen. So I was a little surprised by it because, of course, other Democrats have accepted the endorsement. And she, I think, has been a bit more aggressive in saying, no, let me run my own race. But the argument for it is understandable. In Kansas, I still think she is slightly behind in that race, in part because of just the demographics of Kansas. The first congressional district is so heavily Republican that, and Roger Marshall, of course, is from there, that he will rack up, you know, 65-35 margins, maybe 70-30. And it's so difficult to overcome that in other districts. Johnson Countyans will, by the way, if we have Johnson Countyans on the call, your importance in this race is, it cannot be understated or overstated. Because if Barb Beaulieu is to have any chance, she needs to run up huge margins in the third district, which of course includes Johnson and Wyandotte County. And then do well in Wichita, which is the other competitive place in the Kansas race. So I think she's behind maybe 3 or 4 points. Now, whether the fight over the Supreme Court judge will change that, I don't know. My hot take, there are not a lot of people agree with this, but hey, I live to be on the fringes of political thought. But my hot take is the Democrats might be better served if they move past this debate fairly quickly and got back to COVID. I think that the response to COVID-19 in this country and the 200,000 dead people is an enormously difficult thing for Donald Trump and his party to explain away. And to the extent that this is a referendum on how COVID was dealt with, I think Republicans are in more trouble than they are on the Supreme Court nomination, which is going to be approved no matter what Democrats do. Then let me talk about Nicole Galloway on the other side of the state line. I think she too is behind, but I think she's looking at the same dynamic in some ways that Boyer is, which is if she can make the Missouri governor's race a referendum on Mike Parson's response to COVID, her chances increase dramatically, because Missouri's response has just not been what it should have been. And, you know, you're up to 1,900 deaths now and in 6 months. And I was told the other day that I wrote a column about how Governor Parson, after he got COVID, had made some comments about how the state is different, you know, between Kansas City and St. Louis and Carter County, Missouri, which is in the near the boot heel. And so I went and looked at the actual COVID response in Carter County, and surprisingly, there is triple the number of cases in terms of case rate in Carter County as there is in Kansas City. Now, not absolute numbers, of course, because there are far fewer people who live in Carter County. But on a, you know, cases per 10,000 people, Carter County is triple that in Kansas City. And so COVID is an issue in rural areas. I got an email from a guy who said they haven't even heard of COVID down there. They don't wear masks. They don't distance. They act as if it doesn't exist. And I think to the extent you can make that a critique of Governor Parson, that may have some stick to it. So, but I think she's behind. I think Barbeau-Yay are both behind. We live in two red states. And all things being equal, the Republican has some advantage in both places. Thanks for the question.
Sorry about that. Helena Buckman on the chat says, what are your thoughts on the Kansas State legislative races this year? Any standout races in your view?
We did several endorsements on the Kansas side in August. In the Republican Party, arguing for the more moderate candidates in about five or six races, virtually all of them lost. John Scuba lost, some others. I think the Kansas legislature is going to be more conservative in 2021 than it was in 2020. I think that's because there's not a lot of participation at times in the primary, and it's hard to separate out some candidates. And let's just be honest, the Republican Party is a more conservative, more litmus test party than it was maybe even 20 years ago. So there are no particular races I'm watching. In fact, I spent some time yesterday, or actually Friday, going through the candidate lists in our area, to try and identify some races where we might have make a difference in terms of moderates and others. And we really, Jane Dirks is very conservative. Mike Thompson, my old colleague at Channel 4, is very conservative guy. And so I think the Senate it will be more conservative, and maybe the House as well. I do think that the legislative process in Kansas may be helped a little bit by the retirement of Susan Weigel, the Senate president. I think she could be at times very obstinate and make it difficult to reach compromise. Again, the membership is going to be very, very far right of center, and that's going to make progress more difficult. And for the next 2 years, of course, Laura Kelly is on the clock in terms of facing voters in 2022. And so it will be in the Republicans' interest to try and resist any initiatives she might propose. The other thing to keep in mind is Kansas and Missouri are going to face a nightmare next year because the finances of their states have been blown up by COVID. In some ways, not as much as some people anticipated, but still the difficulties in making the budgets balance is going to be huge. And, to the extent Republicans in Kansas particularly, but Missouri as well, decide not to participate, it's going to be that much harder. That would be true, by the way, if Nicole Galloway wins in the governorship in the 6 weeks as well. Thanks for the question.
Yeah, Richard Thompson, you got a question. He's got his hand up.
Fire away, Richard.
What can we do to inform the public about the true nature of Amendment 3 in Missouri and what it's actually doing rather than what the legislature framed it as?
That's a good question, and we're going to be writing about it. And I had Sean Nicholson on my program that I do with Channel 4 called Four Star Politics. I recommend it to everybody. It's a half-hour digital-only show that goes up every Wednesday, and it's me and John and guests talking about political issues. It's posted at kansascity.com and at fox4.com. And by the way, our guests this week include Nicole Galloway and Amanda Atkins, and they were also going to analyze the presidential debate Tuesday. But I think that there is a pretty good understanding among most voters that Amendment 3 requires a no vote. It's a redo in some ways of the vote that they cast in 2018 for that amendment. I think what you're referring to is the idea that as part of Amendment 3, if you vote yes, the way the census counts districts for statewide representation will change, and children won't be counted anymore, which is just appalling, that somehow children are not citizens in this country and shouldn't be counted for legislative apportionment. It's just foolishness. And so I think the Star's editorial board certainly will be involved in this, and there are other places to see it. There is no, maybe you've seen it differently, but I don't really see a lot of organized support for Amendment 3 other than the Republicans in the legislature and whatever arguments they can bring to bear. But, you know, Missouri, how do we explain that Missouri has all statewide Republicans, super majorities in both houses of the legislature, 6 of 8 House seats, and yet passed Medicaid reform, you know, passed right to work. I mean, it's a very, you get the sense that Missourians, when they study the issues, make their voices pretty clear, less clear when they go to the polls for Vote for People. But we're going to be involved in that. There's no question about it.
Michael, you're up. Yes, sir.
Yeah, go ahead.
So my question deals with stuff that's been happening for quite a while since in the 70s, and that's the rise of inequality. And I'm wondering how that has played into where we're at today and what we can do about it. We can't reshuffle the wealth and create a new deal, obviously, but there has to be some way to legitimize the Democrats among the larger body of the Democratic voters. And I'm wondering, just telling how bad Republicans are, we all know that, but somehow there's a lot of Democratic voters that don't feel aligned with the Democratic leadership. And I'm wondering what can be done to address that.
Yeah, I think that's true. And I think it's an interesting phenomenon because obviously the figures unquestionably show a wider wealth gap in this country over the last 30 or 40 years. The Democrats have not been able, in my view, to really turn that into an electoral issue in many ways, in part because there is, even in the Democratic Party, and just broadly among independents as well, and there's polling that backs this up and research that backs this up, there's less objection to this kind of economic division than you might expect. You know, among the middle class. It just doesn't seem to resonate among people in the so-called middle class. They judge political economic efficacy far more on their own personal circumstance than they do on the rich CEO or the rich boards of directors. That's not universal, of course, but there's clear evidence of that in the polling and in research. In addition, the economic argument was often made over the last 30 or 40 years by organized labor union members who were reliable Democratic votes and who were in conflict with CEOs and business, broadly speaking. And union members there have been two undeniable trends in union membership. One, it's declining. To 6 or 7% of Missouri now, I think is the figure, and the low double digits, if that, nationally. And those who have remained in organized labor, in labor unions, have increasingly voted for Republicans because they're voting on social issues like guns much more than they are on economic issues, which is an old argument. And I've told people this story before, but in 2000, I was at the Democratic National Convention, covering the convention in 2000 in Los Angeles. And we, after a session, we went out with some of the delegates for a drink just to talk politics. And I remember talking with a labor union member from the Kansas City area who was a delegate. And I said, well, so how's Al Gore going to do with labor? And his answer was very, very badly because of guns. They want to vote on guns. They don't want to vote on the economic disparity. They don't want to vote on incomes. They're not voting on government programs. They're voting on guns. And to the extent that that continues to be a problem, it's harder for Democrats to make their economic case. It may play into this, you know, other dynamic that I've talked about in terms of delegitimacy of the government itself, if that gap continues to get wide. But it just hasn't resonated as a political issue in a way that healthcare has, or for that matter, gun rights or immigration or other things that we talk about all the time. Good question, though. Great question.
We're going to go to Phyllis Westover, and then we'll go to Craig Vollen.
Okay. After that. Can you hear me? I seem to.
We can.
Okay. Dave, since you've been thinking about it since age 13, how do we get rid of the Electoral College?
Well, Phyllis, you're probably aware of the compact that's now being discussed among several states, the popular vote compact.
Yeah, but say more.
Yeah, it's an agreement among some states, passed legislatively, in which those states pledge their electoral votes, which they're, of course, entitled to do, not to the winner of the vote within their states, but the winner of the national popular vote. And that compact goes into effect when the number of signees equals or exceeds 270 electoral votes, which is the right. What you need for a majority. And the idea is if you could get that many states to sign up, then whoever wins the popular vote would have the majority of electoral votes. And that would be an extra constitutional way of doing it. And I think they're at like 180 votes now committed, 190. I haven't looked for some time, but they're still short of the goal, but not overwhelmingly short of it. There would almost certainly be a lawsuit or many lawsuits filed against the compact if it ever came to that. The bigger issue is you know, a constitutional amendment to eliminate the Electoral College, which I think will eventually happen. I don't think it'll, you know, I'm 65. I don't think it'll happen in my lifetime. But particularly if again, people who lose the popular vote continue to win the presidency as they have in the, you know, two elections this century, you know, people recognize the absurdity of it and they'll put up with it once, maybe twice, but I shudder. I'm not, again, trying to be apocalyptic, but I shudder to think what will happen if Donald Trump wins this November again with a minority of popular votes. I mean,
I see a civil war.
I mean, well, I tried to shy away from violence, but you know, Republicans, I think, and opponents of that will eventually come to realize that the delegitimacy of the government is more harmful than the effects of letting the popular vote proceed. No argument for the Electoral College stands up to scrutiny. It doesn't protect small states. It doesn't mean that presidential candidates will come and visit you if you're a small state. No, none of the candidates are going to Wyoming to campaign because it's a small state, or Rhode Island. The only thing that matters is whether you're perceived as competitive or not. And that has limited this campaign, as you know, to about five states who are deciding for the rest of the country. And the absurdity of that outcome, again, you know, we all went to school, we all learned about these things, and we're willing to accept them. I mean, I think when George Bush won in Bush v. Gore, there was frustration with it, but and I talked earlier about norms in politics. Al Gore came out and said, look, you know, it's not worth the disruption to continue to to object to this outcome, even though I won the popular vote. And that was a normative decision by a Democrat to say, look, our norms call for a gracious concession to the loser. And the American people said, okay, you know, we don't like it, but we accept it. It's just, it's a quirk of our system. But if it happens again, after happening 4 years ago, then I do think pressure for some sort of change will be really monumental, you know, on policy grounds and just on the more fundamental grounds that I talked about earlier.
Well, let's go to Craig Vollen, and then after him, I'm going to go to Evelyn Maddox.
Thanks. That was very good, Dave. Further on the question of delegitimacy, I read recently that the state of California has 40 million people and the third largest economy in the world, which means, well, let's suppose then that Donald Trump wins and carries on with his autocratic and erratic governance, or he loses and refuses to leave, and we get to a crisis point. Would it be possible, or could it happen, that California will just say, we're leaving?
Well, Craig, great to hear from you, and a good question, interesting question. But by the way, just let me say parenthetically, I think that Donald Trump, if he loses, will leave. I think his statement, I don't see anything sinister in his recent statements. I just think it's more Donald Trump ignorance, to be just blunt about it. I mean, I just don't think he, I mean, the idea that somehow he would lose and wouldn't leave the White House just is beyond the ken, although a lot of things have happened, of course, beyond the ken over the last 4 years. So I don't think that's likely. I will tell you that what you're talking about is what my friend Burdette Loomis down at KU called soft secession. First of all, I don't think actual secession is in the cards. That's what we fought a civil war for. But there is a dynamic called soft secession, which lots of states undertook during the Obama presidency, Texas, Missouri, Kansas, you know, passing rules that said we're not bound by what Obama does. There were attempts, as you know, to overturn the ACA in some states. And so you're seeing the reverse of that phenomenon in California. In my view, that's not completely healthy because once you allow California to make up its sort of own rules and approaches to the national government, you're inviting Alabama and Mississippi to do it too. And, you know, the inherent tension between the states and the federal government, which have been part of our democracy, our republic democracy, since its founding, is as profound now as I've ever seen it. But you know, in my view, and it's just an opinion, it's more harm than good comes when states start to declare themselves out of the protection of the union. And the answer in California, but what you're seeing is California saying, wait a minute, why are we less important than Wyoming? I mean, you know, I did this math the other day, and you get, you know, every senator in Wyoming represents about 600,000 people, I think. I don't have in front of me. And every senator in California represents about 33 million. So, you know, that's a dilution of votes that will infuriate people and feeds into this dynamic. But just as a personal view, I don't think it's healthy. I just don't.
Thanks.
How about going to Evelyn Maddox?
Yeah, hi, and I've so appreciated your talk today. I hope maybe we could just read this script in the Star sometime.
Yeah, I appreciate that. You know, we are not, this may, on people on this call may not be happy to hear this, but we will almost certainly not be endorsing either candidate in the presidential election in the Star, because we've just decided that our voices at that level might get drowned out. And we certainly don't get a chance to interview the candidates. When we do endorsements, we actually interview candidates often together in a sort of a mini debate. And that's very clarifying for us. And we just don't think Donald Trump and Joe Biden will agree to sit down for the Star's editorial board together.
Well,
But the broader sense, yeah, I plan to write about this in a broader sense as we get closer to Election Day.
My question has to do with the nomination for the Supreme Court Justice. There are a lot of voters who simply vote on the abortion issue. Mm-hmm. Now that he has nominated somebody who is so clearly pro-life, and quite frankly, her judicial prudence, I think, is questionable. But no matter what, those voters who vote on the abortion issue have to be happy with her nomination. How do you see her nomination affecting the abortion vote?
Well, a good question. We'll have to wait and see. But no one doubts from reading her past decisions and her statements that she is a pro-life or would be a pro-life justice. I do think there is a slight chance, it's very slight, but there is a slight chance that she, as an originalist and a traditionalist, would understand the meaning of stare decisis and decide that even though she personally opposes abortion, that the fundamental right protected in Roe v. Wade would be upheld. Now, as we all know, it's not a matter of whether Roe v. Wade is thrown out by the court. It's rather states legislating up to a line that makes abortions extraordinarily difficult to get and a regulatory environment. And that's what's often contested before the court. And I do think that she, in essence, would allow many more restrictions on the right, but may not support overturning the right altogether because of the precedent set by Roe v. Wade. That I may be dead wrong on that. It could be that you now have 5 votes on the court to just overturn Roe and allow the states to legislate abortion going forward. Interestingly, as you know, in Kansas, the state Supreme Court has said that the state constitution includes a fundamental right to abortion, which cannot be overturned. And so Roe v. Wade might have less impact in Kansas than it would in some other states. But the blunt reality of it is that the Republicans appear to have the votes. And if they have the votes, there's just not much that Democrats can do to stop this nomination. And I must say, everything I've read says that this judge certainly is respected in the legal community. And she's just, you know, it's not like, you know, putting Judge Judy on the court or, you know, somebody that's not obviously not qualified, but she has very, very obvious pro-life views and the restrictions on the ability and access to abortions will almost certainly go up if she's confirmed.
Yeah, I do want to say to my friends on this call that when I read that she had said that the purpose of the judicial system is to create the kingdom of God, that just struck fear into my Unitarian heart. And yeah. Thank you, Dave.
Yeah, and I appreciate the call. I got into a bit of a Twitter skirmish yesterday, which is a huge personal failing and for which I deeply apologize. But I think it's possible to oppose the nomination of Amy Barrett and not be considered anti-Catholic. You know, Josh Hawley sent a letter to the Senate minority yesterday saying, boy, if you're against her, you're against Catholics and there's Catholic prejudice. I am Roman Catholic, if anyone cares. I think that's malarkey. You know, you can oppose people on secular grounds and not be, not have your concerns based on religion or faith. And by the way, if that were true, then Joe Biden is a Catholic. If you were against Joe Biden, you would be anti-Catholic. That's ridiculous on its face. So, you know, I always get nervous. I'm a First Amendment guy. And when you start tangling religion with government, I always get nervous.
We got Richard with his hand up again. We have Claudine with her hand figuratively waving at me on the. Let's take it. This would be Claudine's first. Can you unmute, Claudine? Unmute.
You there, Claudine?
There she
goes. I am.
All right.
There we go.
Fire away.
My question is, considering the age of this. A new person that would come onto the Supreme Court, and that the Supreme Court justices are allowed to be on for life. What can be the process to change that part of our Constitution? We have a limit on, FDR. After FDR, we put a limit on the presidency. We have a limit on the Senate, on the representatives. What does it take for us to have that changed in our Constitution?
Well, of course, there are the rules that you follow when you have to have, and I'm doing this off the top of my head, but I think 2/3 of the Congress and then 3/5 of the states. But don't hold me to that. I have to go back and look. But there's a process requiring super majorities, let's put it that way, to amend the Constitution. And there is some discussion of putting term limits on Supreme Court justices. You may have heard that there's support for an 18-year term, that lifetime appointments are probably not the best idea. If Amy Barrett is confirmed, she'll be a justice, one assumes, for 30 or 40 years. Into the future, and that really does impact the way the country is governed. So you would have to amend the Constitution. Now, here's Dave Helling's hot take for the day for all of my friends and guests. There's a lot of talk among the Democrats of adding seats to the court if they take over the Congress and the presidency. I think a more interesting thing would be to subtract seats. Don't add seats. Take 2 seats away. Why do we need 9? How about 7? Early in our country's history, we had 6 Supreme Court justices. I mean, there might be a way to say, look, we don't need all 9. Now, whether that would pass legal scrutiny is another thing. But it seems to me shrinking the court, because how can a conservative be against shrinking government?
Touche.
You just go, hey, we're going to shrink the court by 2 seats and see what happens. That's my hot take for the day. Thanks for the question.
I've got to interrupt here. We're going to run out of time. If you all want to stick around for a little while, we'll have a discussion. We'll open it up for discussion like we did in the library, and the recording will go off.
Thank you for tuning in to All Souls Forum. Keep your dial tuned right here at 90.1 FM KKFI, Kansas City Community Radio, for your jazz afternoon coming up immediately with KC, followed by the Boogie Bridge with Jason Bavoni at 3 p.m., and then the Heartland Labor Forum, 6 p.m. this evening. In the meantime, have a great day.
Community Voices is a production of 90.1 FM, KKFI, Kansas City Community Radio. It is our way of letting the voices of our neighbors be heard. Any opinions and views expressed are those of the speakers only, and not necessarily those of Midcoast Radio Project, KKFI, board, staff, or volunteers.
Hi, I'm Larry Bradley. I'm an election reform advocate. Murphy's Law says that what can go wrong will go wrong. A corollary of Murphy's Law is that before you do anything, you have to do something else first. If you're someone who's dissatisfied with our politics and government today, the policies it sets, the laws it passes or doesn't pass, the budgets it approves, and the judges it appoints, then you need to realize that the thing we need to do first to change those things you're dissatisfied with about our government is election reform, not term limits or constitutional amendments. The source of our problems is the way we run our elections. We have the behaviors and the outcomes we have from elected officials because of the way we elect them. We will continue to have those same unsatisfactory behaviors and outcomes so long as we run our elections the way we do now. If we want different behaviors and outcomes from elected officials, then we have to change the way we elect them. The prime thing that's wrong with how we run our elections is the kind of ballot we use. That ballot does not guarantee someone will win with 50% plus one or better of the vote. That ballot encourages the negative campaigning you endure and enables the influence of money in our elections. Even more importantly, the ballot we use now limits the choices you have as a voter. You feel you can't vote for the candidate you want to vote for because you're afraid that doing so will enable the candidate you most oppose to win. Because of this, third-party and independent candidates are discouraged from running, which means you're denied fresh approaches to governing. The good news is that the power of computers makes it possible to change to another form of voting called ranked choice voting. With ranked choice voting, you're no longer limited to one choice. You get to rank your preferences. If your first choice doesn't win, then your second choice counts. If your second choice doesn't win, then your third choice counts until someone gets a majority. The state of Maine has already made the change to ranked choice voting. Maine uses this ballot for almost all its statewide and federal office elections. Maine has even approved it for the general presidential election. I'm speaking to you today because we want the other 49 states to do what Maine has done, along with a number of cities like Minneapolis, Santa Fe, Memphis, and San Francisco. Everywhere that ranked choice voting has been used, exit polling has clearly shown the process to be simple, easy to understand, and clearly preferred to the old system. At the Center Strikes Back, we are working to inform and enable voters to get the election reform they need to have more effective and efficient government. You can access this information through our website at thecenterstrikesback.org, which also links to our blog, or go to our Facebook page at The Center Strikes Back. On the website, you'll find a clear explanation of our three prime election reform proposals. Our blog and Facebook page give you examples of how election reform would allow us to resolve the conflicts we have today and what activities are going on that you may want to join in with. The Center Strikes Back is allied with other organizations seeking election reform, such as fairvote.org, betterballotkc.org, and governmentbythepeople.org. To get the election reform we need to change state and city election laws. That means we either need to persuade already elected officials to pass these new laws or elect people who will go into office committed to changing our election laws. Come to our website and we'll equip you to approach and persuade both elected officials and candidates to support election reform. Remember this, doing the same things the same way and expecting different results is a definition of insanity. And to paraphrase a mentor of mine named Jim Rohn, if we will change, then everything will change for us. Thanks very much for listening. This has been Larry Bradley with Community Voices for KKFI.
Thank you for tuning in to All Souls Forum. Keep your dial tuned right here at 90.1 FM KKFI, Kansas City Community Radio, for your jazz afternoon coming up immediately with KC, followed by the Boogie Bridge with Jason Bavoni at 3 p.m., and then the Heartland Labor Forum, 6 p.m. this evening. In the meantime, have a great day.